Hi everyone, just a quick warning, this episode briefly alludes to child abuse at two points. I will leave timestamps in the description if you'd like to skip these mentions, but if you'd rather skip out on this one altogether, that's completely fine too. Do the thing that makes you the most comfortable. Now cue the intro. Hi there, I'm Ari Lynette, and today's episode is about a recent Disney Channel film franchise. Now, if you listened to the episode about my Twitter rabbit holes, you might remember that I briefly talked about my fascination with Disney's failures and the inner workings of such a corporation. However, this is not that episode, because what I'm talking about today is not a failure, and I wouldn't even classify this as bad. This is something that's got a lot of good things about it, some bad things about it, and some things I mostly appreciate ironically. It's a broad mix, but it leans more positive. And you'll understand what I mean by all these things when I introduce the subject of this week's episode. So, this week I'll be trying my best to explain the weird and wonderful world of Disney's Descendants. This is the series of Disney Channel original movies that premiered from 2015 to 2019. And also had a series of animated webisodes, live-action webisodes, costumes, merchandise, soundtrack albums, multiple series of books, and my favorite thing, a doll line. But this episode's going to make a lot more sense if I only really talk about the films. I'll pull in some supplementary material from the books and the webisodes where I need to, but the main focus of this episode is going to be the trilogy of live-action movies, Descendants 1, 2, and 3. These were all directed by Kenny Ortega, who directed the High School Musical series, and you can kind of tell because they both have the same kind of fun energy to them. So the entire conceit of this franchise is that all of the fairy tale characters from the Disney animated canon, the famous Disney legacy of animation, has been united as part of Auradon, which is a kingdom ruled by King Beast and Belle from Beauty and the Beast. All of the villains from all of these movies have been rounded up and put on an island named the Isle of the Lost, while the good characters, I'm going to use quotation marks for that, live idyllic lives in Auradon until the new king issues a decree to invite four of the villain's children over to study at Auradon Prep and hopefully be assimilated into society as good people. Hijinks ensue, morality is a question, magic is involved, and it's a musical, so expect around six or so songs to be jammed in there, and a couple more extra on the soundtrack. This series is not bad. There are things I genuinely like about it, and I can appreciate without a slither of irony. It's also not a disaster piece like Cats. But it is a Disney Channel original movie, which is definitely targeted to that audience. There are cringy moments, flimsy logic, sometimes it's a bit hammy, but there are also some genuinely good moments, great performances, and, dare I say, some absolute bangers on the soundtracks. So if you are wanting to listen to this and hear some kind of savage takedown of a piece of media made for kids, you're not going to get that here. That's not what I'm here to do. But this is a set of films that establishes a pretty strange universe. And yes, I'm going to roast parts of it because some of it is just plain strange. I want to quickly clarify that when I'm talking about something during this episode, I never intend for it to be offensive or inflammatory towards the people involved. Lots of great people were involved in this series. And though there were choices made with certain story elements, I want to be as respectful as possible. All of the cast and crew seem absolutely lovely, and I wish them all the best. One last thing before we start. I want to briefly talk about the Cameron Boyce Foundation. If you didn't know, Cameron Boyce, who played Carlos in the Descendants films, passed away shortly before the release of the third film due to an epileptic seizure. Last year, his family set up the foundation to continue the work in philanthropy that he was really passionate about. This includes programs to end gun violence, raising awareness for epilepsy and sudden unexplained death in epilepsy, or SUDEP, which I didn't even know was a thing until I looked on the website and found out about it. while also continuing with the projects that Cameron was a part of, like the Thirst Project, which helped to build wells and bring awareness to the global water crisis. I'd highly encourage you all to take a look at the website. It's an amazing cause, and I don't just say that flippantly. I've actually learned quite a lot of things from the website. So I've left it in the description, and there you can find out all about the current projects and what they've been doing overall. It's something I would really recommend taking a look at, so please check that out. All right, on to the episode, and on to the first Descendants film. We start our journey in 2015 with the release of the first film in the Descendants series, creatively titled Descendants. The first thing we see is an explanation of the universe, but like a Cliff Notes version of it. All the Disney kingdoms got united, the villains got rounded up and put on the Isle of the Lost, with no magic, no Wi-Fi, and no way out. They've been kept on this island for all this time until the Beast and Belle's son, Ben, who's about to be made king, makes a decree to bring a group of Isle children into Auradon. Just a quick note, Ben is still a teenager. His parents are very much alive and well. There's no indication that they're about to pop the clogs anytime soon. But no, he's going to be king at like 16. I'm almost 22 and I don't know if I'd be mentally prepared enough to do that, but he's got a good idea, so we'll let him off for his sin of age. So, the main villains that get featured and have their children brought over to Auradon are Jafar, Cruella de Vil, the Evil Queen, and Maleficent, who is established to be the most dangerous one of the lot. This is where we get into our first weird thing. Some of these villains died in their original films. They are alive again here, which is not explained in the film, but it is explained in the books. King Beast brought these villains back to life after death, obviously, just to be imprisoned on this island, because apparently death was too lenient a punishment for them. How petty. But not only do they get to live on the island, they get to have children and raise them on the island. We're just going to skip past how they had children and direct our attention to the fact that these children are being raised in potentially abusive and dangerous households on an island stricken with poverty. It's not until Ben's about to become king that anyone questions this. Maybe it's not such a good idea to have a bunch of children trapped in an island prison in the literal slums full of dangerous villains. Like, some of them have reformed, which is great, but some of them are still pretty evil, or at least just not great people. Like, the Beast was a bit of a tyrant in his time as king, and I'm not exactly an expert in the justice system, but I sense a bit of an issue there. And when Ben announces his proclamation, they're like, no, we can't do this. And Ben's just like, well, that's my decree, so suck it. Not exactly those words. But overall, I agree with him. Teenage King makes some valid points. And then we get to meet the villain kids, or the VKs, which I'll refer to them as such on occasion, because villain kids is too long. We need two letters, guys. And they have the most creative names you'll ever hear. I hope you're ready for this landmark creativity from Disney. So Maleficent's daughter is named Mal, Jafar's son is named Jay, the Evil Queen's daughter is named Evie, and then Cruella de Vil's son is named Carlos, which is slightly more creative. These are the main characters of the first film and appear throughout the series. Mal is the bad girl who does graffiti and steals candies from babies, you know, real rebellious stuff. Jay's a thief who steals stuff, stealing is the theme here, but he steals stuff for his father's pawn shop. Evie's a heartbreaker who wants to marry a rich prince, and Carlos is smart but very scared of dogs. This is where they start off in the film, and they definitely evolve as things go along, so that's why my descriptions of them were quite brief, because there's evolution that goes on. But they are introduced in the first song of the film, called Rotten to the Core, a song about how they're bad. It's honestly pretty catchy, and it's got some awesome choreography. The boys do parkour and jump on roofs, and then there's this killer dance break near the end, and it's dubstep. I know people really love High School Musical, but High School Musical didn't have dubstep, so that's a point for Descendants. Once the song finishes, the film wastes absolutely no time in letting these kids know that they're off to Auradon. The news is delivered by one of the film's best characters, Maleficent, played by Kristen Chenoweth. And she is amazing in this film. She's devious and evil, but she's also campy and fun. She gets a song later on where she does one of her signature high notes. Yes, honestly, 2020 has not been the best year, but at least I lived in the same era as Kristen Chenoweth's Maleficent. So, she wants the kids to steal the fairy godmother's magic wand and break down the barrier so the villains can run free. Remember this. Once this is established, the kids get to go to Auradon in a big black limo as it drives over a magically appearing bridge. Just a heads up, the CGI in this film is a bit rough, especially in the first one. But it's not on a Disney theatrical budget, remember. This is a Disney Channel film. So, they head to Auradon and introduce themselves to the people there, including Ben, his girlfriend Audrey, and the fairy godmother, who's the headmistress. Then during the night, we go on a little bit, they attempt to steal the magic wand from the museum. They fail, but they manage to get out unnoticed because the security guard is asleep and Carlos manages to intercept a call and say it's a false alarm. He basically saves their asses. Good for him. Then they have to go to remedial goodness class in the morning and integrate themselves into the landscape of high school. I know I'm going very quick with this summary, but that's because it's not that relevant. And over the course of the film, all the villain kids get their own stories about learning that maybe they're not so bad after all. So, for example, Jay learns to be a team player, Evie learns that it's good to be smart and not put her value in how marketable she is to a prince. And Carlos, who was never really that bad in the first place, learns that dogs are actually lovely and his mother just scaremongered him into fearing dogs. Now, these arcs are more straightforward and they don't take up as much time because the real complicated story arc is Mal's, because she's the protagonist and really the focus of the trilogy. And she's kind of not a great protagonist. She's a bit selfish and unlikable at times, which is really the fault of the way she's written and what the writers make her do throughout the films. Don't get things twisted. I think Dove Cameron's a great actress and she does a solid job with the material, but she's been given some not great things to do here. It can kind of justify it in the first film because technically she's still evil here, but you'll come to see that doesn't really go away as much as it does with the other three characters. But in this film, she's the one who's really leading the charge to get her hands on that darn wand because she wants to make her mother proud, because her mother is never proud of her. She tries to get involved with the fairy godmother's daughter, Jane, by fixing her hair via magic and validating all of her very toxic self-esteem issues. And then she finds out about the coronation. This is where Ben becomes king, and they're all invited. But the only person who can get close enough to the wand, other than obviously Ben's family and Ben himself, is his girlfriend. And this is where things get icky. Validating toxic self-esteem issues wasn't icky enough. So Mal and the other VKs make a love potion and put them in some cookies, which she gives to Ben so that he falls in love with her. This is technically a drugging! Of course, that term is not used in the film, but he does essentially get drugged into falling in love with Mal and breaking up with Audrey. He proclaims his love to the whole school through song, and Mal's got a spot in the front row of the coronation. But then they go on a date, and Mal doesn't know if she wants to be bad. She started to have genuine feelings for this guy, and she has an inkling that she's been getting this whole thing wrong. And she expresses this, you guessed it, through song. In fact, all of the VKs feel like that, but only she gets to sing about it. Sorry, folks. The next day, it's family day. And this is where all of the students' families get to come to Auradon Prep for some reason. It's like a festival. They don't explain what it is or why it is. Just go with it, guys. But the villains obviously don't get to go because they're still on the aisle, for good reason. So they get a video chat with the kids instead, which goes about as well as you expect. After that, Ben introduces his new girlfriend to his parents, who are rather surprised, but they just go with it. Part of me thinks they just didn't really like Audrey. And then we meet Queen Leia, who is Audrey's grandmother, and the mother of Princess Aurora. Audrey is Sleeping Beauty's daughter, by the way, I forgot to mention that. At first, Queen Leia finds Mal charming, before Audrey points out that she's Maleficent's daughter. And Queen Leia is, I think, understandably pissed, because Maleficent basically robbed her of raising her daughter. And then the so-called good kids, including Chad Charming, who tried to get Evie to do his homework for him and is, well, a Chad, start lambasting the VKs about how they'll never be good. The VKs snap back and are ostracized, even by Jane, who gets a bit big for her boots insulting Mal, who then changes Jane's hair back to a bob cut. Because this movie hates bob cuts. And it's just this one. This thing never really returns for the other films, but first movie, very anti-bob cut. Both times that Mal does a girl's hair, they start with a bob cut, and then it gets turned long and wavy and lovely. She did it with Jane, then she did it with Lonnie, who's Mulan's daughter, and is actually one of the nice ones. But this film has a bit of an agenda against bob cuts, and I won't stand for it. Okay, bob cuts aside, the VKs go back to feeling like outcasts and plan to do the steal the wand thingy. So during Family Day, we also get, there's another thing I didn't mention, we also get the worst song in this entire franchise. So I like the vast majority of the songs from the Three Descendants soundtracks, but this one I would throw into the sun. Whoever thought an a cappella rap version of Be Our Guest was acceptable in any circumstance really needs an intervention. Like, I try my hardest to forget this abomination didn't happen, but unfortunately, it's there. It also has zero plot relevance, so like, why? I think they should have cut that out and instead have a song where the other three VKs get to sing about how maybe they might not be so bad after all, and maybe they want something more. And then after they get lambasted during Family Day, they can have a bleak reprise of the song, and that can even lead into Mal's If Only reprise, which is the scene where she makes the antidote brownie. Yes, we get two druggings. The antidote brownie to give to Ben after coronation. Right, speaking of coronation, it's arrived, and everything's getting set up. Mal and Ben arrive at the venue in a lovely carriage, and Mal gives him the brownie to eat for after the ceremony. But Ben eats them right away, which spooks Mal because, oh no, he's going to fall out of love with me immediately, and this is going to ruin everything. But turns out, you're going to lose your shit when you hear this. He knew about the love spell and just went along with it because he thought she had a crush on him and didn't have enough faith to think that it would work out naturally. And the spell wore off in the Enchanted Lake during their date because the Enchanted Lake washes off all spells, and he's just been faking it ever since. Or has he? Ooh, twist. But let's move it along to the coronation. Everyone's in the venue, Fairy Godmother is proceeding, doing her best, using her wand to conduct the ceremony, until a hand grabs the wand. Everyone's shocked. Panic ensues as we cut to the barrier being broken and the villain celebrating. We cut to the wand and we see Jane holding the wand. Ayo! It's another twist. Jane just wants to be beautiful, goddammit, and if her mum won't help her, she'll do it herself. Mal intervenes and takes the wand from her, as well as using it as an opportunity to take control. But Ben starts to convince her that maybe this isn't what she wants. Maybe she doesn't want to be evil. And he's right. She doesn't. None of the VKs want to be evil. They've become happy with their new lives, and they don't want to be the bad kids anymore. So they choose good. But oh no, purple smoke floods the room! It looks horrible, the CGI is really not good here. And Maleficent arrives! She freezes everyone in the room before anyone else can intervene, and it's just between her and the VKs. Gimme the wand, she says to her daughter. But Mal's not having it. The power of love has made her want to be good. Oh, this is so trite. And she faces off in a staring contest with her mother. Which she wins! Turning her mother, one of the most feared and legendary Disney villains of all time, into a tiny lizard to represent the amount of love in her heart. Which is not very much, because she's tiny. Everything gets unfreezed, and Mal gives the wand back to the fairy godmother. She tells Jane that no, you don't need to change yourself, and yes, you are beautiful. And then they all finish things off with a big old Disney Channel dance party, complete with a sequel tease. I like this film for what it is. It's fun and enjoyable, despite its flaws and cringy moments. And I was excited to see what else would happen with this franchise. And stuff did happen. We got a book series, which explained some of the plot holes from the film, expanded the universe a little, provided a bit of backstory. I haven't read the books, but I've heard enough about what's in the books to help me better understand the universe. They also had an animated web series called Descendants Wicked World, which actually aired on Disney Channel as well. And this featured the original cast from the film in voice roles, and also some new characters too. None of these new characters ended up crossing over to the live-action films, but they did get dolls. The first film got dolls, the web series got dolls, the second film got dolls, there was a couple in between 2 and 3 that got released, and then the third film got a whole line of dolls too. And then there's this new wedding line that's just came out. Don't ask me what the hell that's doing and what's going on there. But dolls was something I really appreciated about this franchise. I have a good few of them, including a grand total of 7 Eevees, because she was my favourite from the films, and still is my favourite from the whole series. I just think she's an awesome character. So Descendants was a huge success for Disney Channel, not just in the merchandising department, which was booming with costumes and toys and all sorts of trinkets, but also in the ratings department. It ranked higher than their last 5 original movies, with 6.6 million viewers in the US alone, and was the 5th most watched original movie in cable history. So naturally, it got the franchise treatment, because Disney's good at Disney, and a sequel was greenlit. Let's talk about Descendants 2. The sequel takes place about 6 months after the events of the first, though it was released 2 years after the first film, in 2017. The VKs have settled into their new lives in Auradon. Eevee is a successful fashion designer, Jay is the captain of a new sports team, it's like a fencing team, and Carlos is just generally a lot happier too, and he's also on that fencing team. But Mal is the odd one out here. She's feeling sad because she's been plucked from her old life as a villain kid who could cause mischief just because she wanted to, and into her new role as the king's girlfriend and prospective lady of the court. She started dressing differently, she has blonde hair now, she's trying to be the perfect royal girlfriend. This change isn't really explained in the film, but good thing we have the books to provide that valuable context. While watching, you'd almost think that she'd been pressured to have changed her appearance, by a higher up or even by Ben, but she decides this completely out of her own volition. She gets Eevee to help her and even uses her magic spellbook, which was never necessary. None of this was necessary, Mal. You kind of brought this part on yourself. You chose to change yourself to be more palatable to the kingdom when you could have easily just said, fuck it, and been yourself like all the other villain kids. Jay's still wearing his leather. Didn't make Eevee go brunette. That's on you. Suck it up. But she's sad because she can't go around being a devious little villain kid anymore without realizing that everyone else is actually a lot better off now. They aren't living in literal squalor. They aren't getting berated by their parents. Like, in the books, Carlos was basically abused by his mother, who made him sleep on the floor because she essentially valued her furs over her own son. But no, Mal's having a downer because life as a princess isn't always cracked up to be. Boo-hoo. She uses magic to try and be this perfect royal girlfriend, but then Ben finds out, is pissed because she's been lying to him, while she tries to erase his memory of that very argument they're having. And then she runs off in tears and decides to go back to the Isle via enchanted motorbike. Or maybe it's a Vespa, I don't know. But the Isle's been running under new command since she's left. And this is where we meet Uma. She's Ursula's daughter and the villain of the film. However, villain is a term that I feel reluctant to use here because she honestly has the right ideas here. She's annoyed that she never got to go to Auradon, but also that they've seemingly given up on helping any of the other kids get off the Isle. The whole I never got to go first thing is petty, but the second thing is totally reasonable. Right, even. She's already had this rivalry with Mal before the first film, so she's pretty annoyed to see her getting all this attention as the prospective lady of the court. But also the fact that Mal just seems kind of whiny this time around definitely makes Uma seem a lot more interesting of a character to explore. Also, she's played by Chyna Ann McClain, who just bodies this role. She's amazing in this film. Uma's probably my second favourite character in the series overall. She's that good. So, Mal heads back to the Isle and gets herself a villainous makeover with the help of Dizzy, daughter of one of the ugly stepsisters, and is an actual child working in a hair salon. I guess that's what poverty does to you. Back in Auradon, Eevee finds a note and brings it to Ben's attention that Mal's gone back to the Isle. He wants to go and find her, but Eevee warns him that it's too dangerous to go alone and he doesn't know his way around the Isle. She opts to come with him and brings the boys too. Jay and Carlos are so overlooked in this series, especially the later two films, that often I'll end up grouping them together as just the boys. They do have their own arcs, but everyone kind of takes a backseat for Mal's story, which is a shame because they have some good arcs. Carlos has his romance arc with Jane, and Jay has his struggle getting past traditions to let Lonnie on his sports team. And those are both way more relatable struggles than whatever Mal's going through. And then Eevee, who's my favourite and remains my favourite, she has some moments of genuine emotion. Like, she makes Ben promise she won't get stuck on the Isle again. Like, you can tell she does not want to go back to that life. And then when they all go over to the Isle, dressed in villainous glam for doll reasons, she gets pickpocketed and realizes how desperate these Isle kids are. They're hungry, they're struggling, and now she's in a position of privilege and she doesn't know what to do except let them have the money. That whole arc is way more intriguing than Mel's, and honestly would have made a better story than hers. On the aisle, Ben goes up to see Mel in the VK hideout, who insists she's not coming back to Auradon, though Ben is totally willing to forgive her. Classic Ben. He tries again, but it's clear he's not getting through to her, so he wanders off for a bit and ends up getting captured by Uma's crew. Yes, Uma has her own crew. We have Harry, who's the son of Captain Hook, and Gil, who's the son of Gaston. And with Uma, they make the C3. These are some great character additions. That's something that's really strong about the sequel, are the new character additions. One thing that isn't really strong about this sequel is a little change that happens. Through some magical shenanigans at the start of the film, Carlos's pet dog, Dude, the one he got in the first film, can now talk. And I'm not usually a fan of talking dogs in live-action films as it is, but this is just bad. Bad, bad, bad. Just this recurring gag that does not land. But, I mean, we did get a bunch of good new characters, so this one bad one isn't too scarring. Mal faces off with Uma to get Ben back, and through an arm wrestling match, ends up losing to Uma and has to bring her fairy godmother's wand. Yep, they're doing the wand thing again. But they don't actually steal the wand. Instead, Jay and Carlos go back to Auradon and make a fake wand using their 3D printer. Also, there's this recurring gag where Chad's trying to get access to the 3D printer, and it is actually pretty funny. Chad being comic relief is a lot more fun than Chad being, well, a Chad. Meanwhile, Evie gets a moment with Dizzy, who is like a sister to her back on the aisle, and this fuels her to want to help the kids more. She also tries to get through to Mal, but she can't quite do it either, so they have to say goodbye. We then get a beautiful ballad duet between Mal and Evie. This song was probably intended to be like an ode to best friends never forgetting about each other, but it actually sounds more like a really heartfelt love duet, and honestly, it would have made a better fucking movie. Mal and Evie is a way better ship than Mal and Ben. Change my mind. Jay and Carlos head back to the aisle, but Lonnie comes with them and insists on helping, which is great because Lonnie is a great sword fighter, and that is exactly what the VKs need for this upcoming sword fight. I wasn't very cryptic there, was I? So Mal and Uma face off with a rap battle, which is nowhere near as cringy as that sounds. You probably have some images in your head. It's not as bad as that. But Uma definitely is a better rapper than Mal, who just kind of talks over the music. And then Ben gets some painfully auto-tuned singing. Then the transfer of the wand is made, but Uma wants to test it out to see if it's real. Now, it's established in the first film that magic doesn't work on the Isle, but I don't know if the wand counts within that rule, or if it supersedes it. Who knows? Not me. Mal tests out the fake wand on the talking dog to make it look like they'd made the dog be able to talk there and then, but then Uma quickly finds out afterwards that the wands are fake, and sword fighting ensues. And honestly, the sword fighting is pretty good. The VKs win because they have Lonnie, and also because they just happen to be pretty good at sword fighting. Then they hop out of the scene and they escape the aisle. However, we pan from the limo exiting the scene to the floor, and Mal's left her spellbook there. Ooh, I wonder if that's going to mean anything. Who am I kidding? Of course it does. But Mal heads back to Auradon with the others and has a heart-to-heart with the other VKs. Carlos finally asks out Jane on a date, and Jay sorts out his problem with the sports team by making Lonnie the captain. One, because she's talented enough to be the captain, and two, because tradition said that the team needs to be made up of a captain and 8 men. But they never said the captain had to be a man, right? Yeah, he could have easily dismantled the system, or even just modified it to make it fairer for more than one woman to get on the team at a time. But we'll have to settle for exploiting wordplay instead. Yay, feminism! And with that, we have a natural conclusion. Only it isn't, because there's still a whole chunk of movie left. Enter the Royal Cotillion, a ceremony that inducts Mal into the Royal Court. It's also on a cruise ship, because reasons. You'll see why later. Everyone gets dressed up, the ceremony begins, and things are looking peachy, until Ben steps out with Uma, because she's going to be the one inducted into the royal court? And Mal's heartbroken, even though she was going to leave him anyway so she could stay on the aisle. But yeah, she's heartbroken. Boo-hoo. But the gang quickly figure out that Ben's been spelled, and with the help of Jane, they give him a reminder of who he really loves. It's a stained glass portrait of Ben and Mel, the real Mel, with a purple hair and classic villain kid style, the Mel he's loved all this time. The spell gets broken, Uma gets pissed and she jumps in the sea. Just regular teenage girl stuff. But no, she's gone in the sea to turn into a giant tentacle monster! I'm not kidding. To which Mal turns into a dragon, just like her mother, to face off against her old rival. But there's another person in this fight. Ben roars at the edge of the boat. Is this the moment we've been waiting for? Is Ben gonna go full beast? He jumps into the water and swims between the two foes to negotiate peace. Oh, bless him. He wants to bake a cake made out of rainbows and smiles because he knows violence is not the way. And weirdly enough, this works? Uma just turns around and leaves, and then Mel goes back on the boat, back to human form, in a brand new purple dress, which is cute, by the way. Then the ceremony proceeds, and they have another, you guessed it, friends, Disney Channel dance party ending. This time with a lot of kicking water about, because a lot of water got on the boat during the fight. But not before Evie sends a list of kids that she'd like to bring to Auradon, starting with Dizzy, who gets her invitation as a post-credit scene. Or is it a mid-credit scene? I don't remember. You know what I mean. And with that, we have the second film. I enjoyed this film a lot, maybe even a little more than the first. All of the songs are good. There's no duds, which I can't say for the first one. We have some great new characters and a logical expansion to the universe with revisiting the Isle and learning how it works, which a lot of people wanted. However, we also get a talking dog and a bit of an anticlimactic ending. Also, the twists aren't as good in this one as they were in the first. But either way, it was a success, getting simultaneous airings across Disney Channel, Disney XD, ABC, Freeform, Lifetime, and Lifetime Movie Network to ratings of 8.92 million viewers combined over the six networks. So naturally, people were wondering when the third film would come out. The answer is 2 years later, with Descendants 3 getting its release in 2019. What's interesting is that there was a lot less franchise building between films 2 and 3 than there were between 1 and 2. The Wicked World series didn't come back, there were far less dolls, and they didn't do as much in terms of like additional media. Maybe Disney had just had it with all these different universes between the films, the books, and the web series, all which introduced different peripheral characters that didn't cross over to the films. Like, there are canonically three different Hook children. You have Harriet from the books, CJ from the web series, and then Harry from the second and third films, and only CJ got a doll. And I doubt it was intended that way. I think the later books just had to stitch together all of the different canons awkwardly, so nothing really makes that much sense in the universe. And to be fair, Descendants 3 does not do much to relieve it. Descendants 3 was a bittersweet experience for a lot of people, because it was seen as the end of the series, and it was also released shortly after Cameron Boyce's death. I think it was a lot of fun and just as enjoyable as the other two films, but I think a lot of the decisions made in this film kind of exposed how strange and nonsensical the setup of the universe is. I think it just brought all of that to the forefront, and because I have to explain all that shit, my dive into this film will probably take a bit longer than what I did with the first two films. Also because a lot of stuff happens in this film. So, let's explain. The film starts with the original VKs going back to the Isle to announce the four kids that will be going to the Isle to start their new lives. And we already have a problem. First of all, one of the kids that gets a spot is Dizzy, who already had a spot to go to Auradon, so it's like they just forgot about that last scene from the second film. And also, why can they only bring four of them? Evie even gets a line saying, "We wish we could take all of you with us, but we can't." And it's like, why can't you? Y'all have limos. You can stuff a bunch of kids in a limo, that sounds bad, and drive them off to Auradon and then come back for more. It's not like all of the original VKs have to go in the limo to pick them up. They can take it in turns. One time they could have the boys go in the limo, or they could have Ben and Evie go and then have the boys prep the dorm rooms. And then Mal could have some time to whine about her life some more. Like, this whole four new kids thing is so unnecessary, and they could have just done things in a much more productive way to really change more lives quicker, like they wanted to in the first place. A week goes on and we cut to Mel, back in Auradon, and she's nervous, because Uma's still out there, and is probably still pissed. This is the day where they do the pickup for the new kids, and before they go, Ben has something he needs to talk about. He serenades his girlfriend with his song from the first film, and then gets on one knee. Yeah, this is a proposal. Teen's getting married, how about that? But she says yes, and they go off to the aisle to pick up the kids. God, it sounds like they're physically married already. But pickup happens, the new kids get into the limo, so let's meet these kids. We have Dizzy, who we already know and love. Then we have Celia, who is Dr. Facilier's daughter, that's the villain from The Princess and the Frog. And then these two twin boys that do nothing throughout the film. They say their goodbyes to their parents, who seem to be more loving, and head off onto the magic bridge. But wait. A hand pops through the closing barrier, and it's Hades! And he's pissed, because he used to be a god, and he doesn't deserve to be trapped on the isle. And this really shakes everyone up. Mal tries to ward him off with her dragon powers, which she does, but it overwhelms her and drains her of her energy. After that scuffle, they head off and attempt to get the new kids settled in. At this point, there's a big aspect of this third film that I haven't mentioned, and that's Audrey. Now, she wasn't in the second film for some reason, hence why I never mentioned her during my description of the second film. It's explained in that film that she's gone for a spa retreat or something, it's kind of a flimsy reason, but she's back in this one. Also, Lonnie isn't in this film, the third film, which isn't addressed or explained at all in the film, but apparently the book said it's because she's graduated, which good for her, just a strange thing to mention. But Audrey is back, and her hair is pink. It's like pastel pink and blue for some reason. She's horrified that Ben and Mal are engaged. And she's also getting a lot of grief from her grandmother. Remember Queen Leia from the first film? Well, she's pissed. That's just the recurring theme for this film. Everyone's pissed. And this time, not logically. She's angry at her daughter for not marrying Ben and being a shame on the family. And it's like, ma'am, you're still royalty, and it's not like Audrey could have stopped any of this. Yeah, she just kind of gets made a jerk in this film. This all sends Audrey spiraling, and she does what every scorned teenager does. She steals the crown and Maleficent's staff from the museum and sings possibly the best song in the whole damn series, Queen of Mean. This song is an absolute jam, and I scream sing it far too often for my own good, despite the fact that I do not have the range. This signals her transformation into the villain of this film. Yeah, Audrey is the villain in this one, and she's the first villain in the series to come from the good side of Auradon rather than from the Isle. And during the marketing of the film, they actually made this a surprise and were very vague in all the trailers about who was going to be the big bad. Was it going to be Hades? Maybe Uma again? What about this new girl, Celia? But no, it's Audrey. And if you've been paying attention to behind-the-scenes pictures or the merchandise, particularly the dolls, because you know who you're talking to, then you'll have found this out already, because it got basically leaked. But either way, it's a lot of fun seeing her as a villain, and seeing all of this energy manifest into something a lot more powerful and exciting. Meanwhile, everyone's worried about Hades and the barrier, and Uma's still on people's minds. She's living rent-free in their minds, and no one knows what to do. So Belle asks Mal, what do we do? You know, like there isn't someone there who's supposed to be in charge of all that. Like, a king, maybe? And once again, we get a moment where the audience, and by that I mean me, questions whether they should even sympathize with this protagonist, because Mal's solution is to close the barrier forever. No more kids coming over, no more any of that stuff. And it's like, oh my goodness. Like, their solution is to, like, stop all of the evil people by sealing off Evil Island forever. And it's like, no? That's the most ridiculous thing about this movie, the whole barrier thing. You want a solution to the barrier problem, huh? You worried about dangerous people getting through your one barrier? Here's a great idea. Have multiple barriers. For an island full of the worst Disney villains of all time, like, the worst of the worst, as they make it out to be, it's bizarre that they only have one level of security to contain them. If I were in charge, which, you know, it's a fictional universe, so that's never going to happen, but I'd at least have, like, triple redundancy. Like, if this measure fails, we have this one. And if that happens to fail, we have something else. And if that happens to fail, then no worry, we have something else. Like, I'd have, in my mind, 5 different magical barriers. It doesn't have to be exactly that, but I think 5 is a good number to settle on. It's not like there are budgetary constraints either. They're made of magic. You don't have to pay any construction fees or hire any workers, even though it would probably be really good for jobs. And if a villain happens to get past a barrier 1, that doesn't mean they'll get past barrier 2 and 5. And the ones in between, those other ones. Sorry, y'all are irrelevant. It's like that one game on Takeshi's Castle with all the doors. Like, it's not that difficult. I feel like I'm analyzing this far too much. Like, more than the writers did when making this movie. But it's like the one big thing that drives the conflict later in the movie. Spoilers. And there's an obvious solution. It's infuriating. But Mal manages to convince Ben to go with her plan while also lying to her fellow VKs, our protagonist. Now we cut to Evie's house, because Evie has a house now. That's awesome. So they're all preparing to go to Jane's birthday party, and Mal steps outside and finds Audrey in her new villain look, which is pretty awesome, by the way, who understandably uses this opportunity to do some evil magic on Mal, and she turns Mal into an old hag. Enjoy this showcase of makeup and prosthetics while it lasts, because it sure doesn't last long. Because now they have to go back to the Isle to get Hades Ember, which is the only thing powerful enough to stop the magic of Maleficent's staff. No, they can't use the power of love this time, they have to get the Ember. So, they grab the motorbikes, which they have now, and put on some villain kid chic costumes, because Evie just has a ton of them apparently, and they're customized perfectly for every character, just in case they have to go back to the Isle, and no, they can't use the ones from last time, because merch. And then they're back on the Isle to look for the Ember. And the minute they set foot there, boom, Mal's back to normal, because magic doesn't work on the Isle. And then they get the motorbike stolen, because, the Isle is full of people living in poverty who have no choice but to steal to survive, and motorbike's probably a pretty hot commodity. And also, the VKs forgot how bike locks work. Meanwhile, at Jane's party back on Auradon, Audrey sets everyone under a sleeping spell, with a lovely rendition of the now public domain Happy Birthday. Except for Chad, who decides to align with her for some reason, but Chad's gonna Chad. And Jane, who uses the Enchanted Lake to evade the spell, because, like with the first film, the Enchanted Lake washes off all spells, and if you're under the Enchanted Lake, you're basically immune to the spell. That's very smart of her. So, Mal goes off to find Hades with Celia, who happened to work for Hades at one point, and knows her way around his HQ. And then, meanwhile, the others wait for her. There's this really cool scene in Dr. Facilier's arcade. Side tangent. He owns an arcade in this movie, and he's also one of the only genuinely supportive parents in this full series. But there's this scene where the Auradon News is reporting on the sleeping spell, and the reporter does not believe that it's Audrey who's done this. So he's like, which villain did this? Which I think is a really interesting little bit of commentary. I just like it. But Mal tries to sneak over to the Ember. We're back to Mal now. Sorry for that jump. She tries to sneak over to the Ember while Hades is asleep. He immediately can tell she's there. And we get the reveal that Hades is Mal's dad. Not only is she part fairy that turns into a dragon occasionally, she's also a demigod. Wow. So they have a sing-off about how Hades was a terrible father and Mal's daddy issues, which is actually said in the song. I'm not using that as a euphemism, surprisingly. And it's a lot of fun to see Cheyenne Jackson and Dove Cameron doing a fun performance together. Hades is great in this film. He's like this campy rock star who can do both the serious stuff and the fun stuff really well. I think we've established that the villains in this film aren't exactly going to stick to Disney canon, so they just work with whatever they want to do. It feels similar to what Kristen Chenoweth did with Maleficent in the first film, and I love it. I loved her performance and I love his performance. No complaints there. After this, Mal manages to convince Hades to give her the Ember pretty easily, dare I say? But it can't get wet, because if it gets wet, it'll just burn out and the magic won't work. Yep, easy does it. Meanwhile, I'm sorry, I'm doing a lot of back and forth. There are a lot of cutting from the Isle to Auradon to the Isle to Auradon again. It happens a lot in this film. I'm sorry about that. I'm just working with the way the film is. But back to Auradon. Audrey confronts Ben, who is trying to fix the whole sleeping spell mess in his lovely diplomatic way, because that's all he can really do. She offers to wake everyone up under one condition. Ben marries her instead of Mel. Ben says no, and Audrey decides that a sleeping spell just isn't enough. So she turns him into... I'm not going to tell you until later. Preserve the surprise. She also starts turning people into stone, including the one person who probably could have stopped all this shit from happening, the fairy godmother, because she just had to run all the way to the Dawn Museum to get the wand. That's sad. Back to the Isle again, where the VKs go out through the barrier, and Mal's appearance changes again. Not back to old hagdom, but she gets a darker outfit and blue highlights in her hair. I don't know why, I don't know how, I think it's supposed to be symbolism for her dual parentage, but either way, I think she looks cooler like this. The blue and purple hair combo is sick. But once they go through the barrier, so do, it's Harry and Gil! They jump through the hole in the barrier, and who's there to greet them but Uma, who rises from the sea, she's been in the sea this whole time, and goes from octopus form to human form, complete with a new hairstyle and a cool new outfit. Uma is still one of the best characters in this series, and 3 only solidifies her position as one of my faves with her redemption arc. Yep, she's got a redemption arc in this film. She offers the assistance of her crew in defeating Audrey under the condition that any kid from the Isle can get the chance to live in Auradon. Mal agrees, and lies, because she knows that's not what's going to happen, and they all go back to the Isle somehow, even though their motorbikes got stolen. I don't know. They never explain it. They just get back, and then everyone's asleep on the grass in front of the school, and Evie finds out that Hannah's been turned to stone. Who's Hannah, may you ask? Well, I don't know, and I'm probably going to go to the grave not knowing, because this is a character we've never seen before, has never even been mentioned before, pretty sure not even in the books. I don't know why this random character got introduced for one scene as a statue. They could have used one of those twin boys that would have given them something to do, or even Dizzy, because she doesn't get very much to do either in this film. But no, we get this random person instead. I was just as confused watching as you are right now listening to this, so I apologize. So for the next chunk of the movie, Audrey watches the gang from Fairy Cottage, her hideout, through the jewel in Maleficent's staff as they go to find Ben, or at least try to. They're led to him by Dude, the dog, who still talks, thankfully much less frequently than last time, but it's still a sin, so I'm still counting it. They don't find Ben, sadly, but they do find a load of claw marks on the walls. Ooh, what could that be? They also find a room full of suits of armor. Audrey then uses these suits of armor to fight the gang from a distance. If that's possible, then that's really cool. So they do some sword fighting. Yeah, we get some more sword fighting, which, I'm being honest, I like the sword fighting in this series. I think it's good. And there's a great song where they all have to work together to beat the knights, and the really good vocal performances. It's pretty awesome. Then Mal casts a counterspell to put the knights under their control and make them dance. Yeah, not everything in this movie is awesome. There's a bit of cringe too. Audrey's pissed, and she screams in anger. This happens like 5 times in this film. Get used to it. Now the gang split off, with the boys going to look for Ben in the forest, and the girls going up to Audrey's room to find some clues. We get some Gil and Jay bonding, which is another example of a cool friendship that's also prime shipping material. Nothing much happens in Audrey's room. They go back to Evie's house and find the new kids under the sleeping spell. They also find Doug, who's Evie's boyfriend and has been here for all of the 3 films, and I just forgot to mention him. Sorry, Doug. He's under the sleeping spell too. Evie wonders whether they're really in love, and if true love's kiss could possibly wake him up. With a song. Yes, it's the moment we've all been waiting for. Well, the moment I've been waiting for. Evie finally gets a solo! This is what I've been wanting throughout this whole series, and it does not disappoint. Let me tell you, Sophia Carson is too talented to only sing backup and side vocals. And she finally gets that solo moment right here. Stream Guess I'm a Liar, which is not the song from this film, but just stream it. Just listen to me, okay? Stream Guess I'm a Liar. The kiss works, Mal and Uma get some bonding time, and we get yet another prime ship with those two. In fact, I'm pretty sure the actresses, Dove and China, both had like a headcanon that Mal and Uma were ex-girlfriends, which I love that headcanon. It's not official like canon, but I like to think it is, because it adds a little layer to their relationship. Back to the boys. They end up finding Ben, In beast mode. Oh yeah. It only took them 5 years and three movies, but we finally get Ben as a beast. It's mostly makeup and practical effects too. It doesn't look amazing, but it looks decent enough. And this is great because one, practical effects are awesome. You know my feelings on practical effects if you've listened to the Cats episode. And two, we've established already that this series isn't very good at CGI. It improves, and they probably would have improved it, but they usually aren't that good at CGI. Carlos tries to calm him down, and then Jane arrives with a super soaker, or similar brand, full of enchanted lake water, which washes off the spell. Aside from some stubble and a pair of fangs, but I'm not complaining. Some more magic stuff happens, Mal and Uma have to stop one of Audrey's spells together, and then the two groups come together again. They head over to Fairy Cottage, which was that one clue they got from Audrey's room. They got one thing, but she's gone already, and all that's left is Chad in a closet. That's just a historic sentence in itself. He's been locked in there because, I don't know, I think Audrey got bored of him. And he's completely emasculated at this point. He runs like fuck, and they're all out of luck, and I'm suddenly a poet. But now we get to something juicy when they go out into the forest. The gang talks about how exciting it is to get more villain kids off the aisle and how that's such an amazing thing. To which Mal says, "Well, actually, no." Again, paraphrasing. And everyone's understandably pissed. We're back to that recurring theme. Uma's pissed because Mal lied to her and made her trust her again. Celia's pissed because she'll never get to see her father again, her loving father, who was like the one good parent in this whole series. So she grabs the ember and throws it into the fountain, therefore rendering it useless. And then Evie's pissed, or more specifically, Evie's devastated. Because all this time, the VKs, the original villain kids, were supposed to be a unit. They were supposed to be the change in the world, and now Mal's undoing all of it. And let me tell you, Sophia Carson acts the shit out of this scene. You can tell she's been properly betrayed by Mal, who's just lied to each and every one of them. And just when you thought things couldn't get worse for poor Mal, all of her friends get turned to stone. All she now has is herself. Time for a solo. It's a good song, but at this point, I don't have the energy to really sympathize with her for lying and planning to seal off the aisle. And just like the whole, "I'm sad now, so I'm gonna sing." Like, sis, you brought that on yourself. Uma even tells her that straight up. It's still a good song, and Dove Cameron delivers with the vocals, so we've got to admire that. So Mal is sad, things are looking pretty bleak. And then she hears cries from atop the castle. Celia's been captured! Mal goes off to face Audrey, who's captured Celia. I hope you got that via context clues. And she's gonna fight her in dragon form, baby! She's trying her best to beat Audrey, but Mal is obviously losing at this point. She's not doing very well. And Uma notices this and has a moment of, oh shit, she might actually die from this. So she goes back to help Mal reactivate the ember. They then defeat Audrey with the power of the ember, and Audrey goes into a deep slumber. Because, Sleeping Beauty's daughter. How symbolic. They can't wake her up because Mal can only do so much with the ember, which, to be fair, Hades did tell that to her earlier on, but I forgot to mention that bit. So they have to get Hades to do it. So Uma, Harry, and Gil all go back to the Isle, as well as Celia, who'd rather stay with her father than be sealed off from him forever. And then Hades comes over to bring Audrey out of her slumber. He's heavily guarded in handcuffs and everything. He gets this really political line about when one of you does something bad, it's an error of judgment. But when one of us does something bad, you lock us up and you throw away the key. And it's like a little on the nose, but it's pretty apt for this situation. I like when Descendants gets a bit political. Audrey wakes up, is remorseful, apologizes to Mal, and vows to be good again. She gets off without so much as a slap on the wrist. Queen Leia also apologizes to Mal. What Queen Leia doesn't do is apologize to her own daughter for sending her into that evil spiral, but bygones be bygones. Hades and Mal share a loving father-daughter moment before he gets sent back to the Isle. And then we fast forward to sometime later, I don't know how much time it is later, and it's Mal and Ben's engagement party. Whoop whoop! Remember, they're engaged. Yeah, you probably forgot too. They're celebrating and they're having some fun, but Mal has a problem. The problem is that she can't be the queen of Auradon unless she's also the queen of the Isle. Which, on one hand, you said that Uma could do that, and now you're taking that away from her, which is yikes. But also, it's a good thing because she wants to take down the barrier for good. Because evil can come from anywhere, and they can't live their lives in fear of people from other territories. Again, a little bit of a political spin there, and I kind of like it. Beast's like, no, we can't do that. And Ben's like, shut up, Boomer. And then the fairy godmother's fine with it, so she gives Mal the wand to break down the barrier. Which is pretty ironic, since that was Maleficent's plan from the first film, you know, breaking down the barrier. But hey, it's uplifting in this one, so we're going to call it uplifting. The magic forms a real physical bridge. Again, no construction fees. Sorry to all those workers. And all of the people from Auradon on one side, and all of the people from the Isle on the other side, they all come together to meet each other and dance on the bridge. The bridge with absolutely no railings or fence that could really be useful to anyone. Apparently, nobody fell off that bridge that day, which is great, but I don't believe it. But either way, it's a classic Disney Channel dance party. I'm sure I don't need to say it. However, this one's a little different because it wraps up everyone's plots along the way. You have Jay going to go off with Gil to explore Auradon, boyfriends. And then Harry flirts with Audrey, and Carlos and Jane are looking to the future. And then finally, Hades comes over, wondering if he's going to get a wedding invite. What fun. But perhaps the best representation of this is the final scene of the film. Mal, Jay, Evie, and Carlos all stand facing the bridge to the Isle, wondering if their parents miss them. They all race over to see who'll get there first. And that's where the story ends. I feel like, though the ending is a bit ironic considering that's exactly what the villains from the first film wanted to do, it still feels like a nice and appropriate ending to the whole series. There hasn't been any confirmation about a fourth film, and I honestly don't think this should make a fourth film. As far as I'm concerned, it wouldn't be right to do it without Cameron Boyce. And also, I feel like the ending of the third film was the right way to close it off, so why do they need to do another one? But then again, I said that about Toy Story 3, and then they made Toy Story 4, and turns out that actually was a pretty good ending. So just ignore me. I might be completely wrong. So, this trilogy is strange and flawed and a bit all over the place. But I have to say, I get a lot of unironic enjoyment out of it. The concept for the film is very exciting. There's a lot of great costumes throughout the series. There are great songs, except for that one from the first film. And I found out about some pretty talented people from it too. Yes, the universe has some big contrivances and some unfortunate implications. And sometimes there are cringy moments, but in my mind, these don't ruin the series. It's almost like a part of its charm for me. And part of me thinks that this is pretty important when looking at a piece of media. We're all allowed to like things that aren't 100% high quality, and as someone who enjoys a lot of media geared towards younger audiences, that's something I've really ran with over the past few years. We can have favourite things that are prestige and high quality and thoughtful. But we can also have favourite things that are just fun and enjoyable and like a little snack, even if all of the contents aren't amazing. We also have like problematic faves, but that's a whole other episode. This isn't a problematic fave. This is a fave that some people might just find odd. And you know what? That's okay. Because I just like what I like. And it just so happens that Descendants is a film series that I really, really like. So that's the episode. If you've seen any of the films and you have thoughts, feel free to let me know on Twitter or DM me on Instagram. I realize I keep saying, come talk to me about it without really providing a lot of ways to do it. Well, that's how you do it. And you can find those links in the description of this episode and all of my episodes. So you can find my Twitter, my Instagram, and my YouTube. I will also be leaving that link to the Cameron Boyce Foundation in the description today. Again, it is an amazing cause, and I'd encourage you all to take a look. As always, if you enjoyed the episode and want to hear more from me, subscribe to the podcast. You can leave a review depending on the platform, or go ahead and share the episode on your socials. Either way, thank you so much for listening. I appreciate it beyond words. And until next time, keep trying your best, everyone. Bye!